Okay, we didn't quite make it through all the 11 systems as we're just briefly going through them. I don't remember whether I've already talked about respiratory or not. I don't have much to say about it. We're slide 12. It's mostly the lungs. They're not the only parts of the system, of course, but the rest of they're the important parts because that's where the gas exchange takes place. And the rest of it is pretty much plumbing to get air into and out of those lungs. 13, digestive system. There's a lot of different parts to the digestive system, but most of them are part of the continuous tube that runs all the way from mouth to anus, which is the alimentary canal. Aliment means nutrition, so alimentary means of food. The alimentary canal makes up most of the structure of the digestive system, but not all of it. For instance, the liver, which is a really large organ, is part of the digestive system, but food doesn't pass through the liver. Food passes through the alimentary canal, and the liver connects to that alimentary canal and delivers stuff to it. The digestive system obviously is about digestion. That's what it's named for. But that's really not, by far, it's not the only thing it does. Digestion is really just something it has to do in order for its even more important purpose, which is to absorb the nutrients. They can't be absorbed into the body until they're small enough, and that's why digestion has to take place first. But that's really just a preparation for the truly important job of absorption. Without absorption, we wouldn't be able to get anything from the food. And in 14, we have the urinary system, which is made up of kidneys, of course. The kidneys are in there. They are the most important organs of the urinary system. They really do the work of forming the urine, but the rest of it is just pretty much just plumbing to deal with that urine once it's produced. It's produced more or less continuously. Where does urine come from? Well, yeah, the kidneys make it, but how does it come to exist? What is urine? That's one of the components, yeah. But urine is just blood that has been filtered. The kidneys are continuously filtering the blood, and so urine is filtered blood. Another way of looking at it is that blood is urine plus other things in there as well. The ureters and the urinary bladder and the urethra, they're just a way of dealing with it as it's being produced. Produced more or less continuously, trickles into the urinary bladder for temporary storage, and then intermittently we release it from the urinary bladder. And then the 11th one on slide 15 is the reproductive system, or reproductive systems, right? Because there are two different versions, one for each of the two sexes. As you probably already knew, that's unusual because it's not true for the other organ systems. They're pretty much the same, male and female. It's also kind of unusual compared to the other systems because the primary purpose of the reproductive system, you can easily live without, right? You don't have to reproduce. Now, there are some reasons why you need the reproductive system just for your own life, even if you choose not to reproduce, but none of the other organ systems are like that. You know, they perform indispensable functions that you can't live without. Okay, that's all the 11 systems. Let's finish up this chapter now. 16 is a kind of a representation of an entire body. It's not shaped like the body, but that's what this box represents. So this is the skin that you see. And inside that box is the body. One thing that we see in this is the fact that there are compartments within the body, including that alimentary canal I was talking about. This whole thing is the alimentary canal all the way from mouth to anus. And one thing you might not have thought about before is that that's not really inside the body. You know, we say all the time that we put food into our bodies, but we don't put food into our bodies unless you inject something in food into your veins, and you should not do that, by the way. You know, when we put food into our mouth, that's not in our body. That's continuous with the air, right? Same space. And that's true all the way through the alimentary canal to the anus. The body is made up of the cells. If something is in your body, it's in the cells that make you up. Well, food is not in your body. This alimentary canal, which is continuous with the outside, the body is really just wrapped around that tube. And the digestion that the digestive system performs really occurs outside the body. You secrete enzymes out of the body into the lumen or the hollow interior of that tube. That's where the food is broken down, digested into molecules that are small enough to then finally enter the body through the small intestine's lining. That's what absorption is. And similarly, the lungs, the inside of the lungs is outside of the body. Right? That's continuous with the air as well. And so is the urinary bladder. Now the blood is kind of, the blood inside the blood vessels is also in its own little chamber within the body, but it's separate from the rest of the cells, right? And so there's a compartmentalization, and you can see that there's blood is, since it's carrying things around, that's its major function, it is continuously exchanging things with these other compartments, like the compartment in the lungs for ventilation, oxygen and carbon dioxide exchange, and as I said before, blood is continuously being filtered by the kidneys to produce urine. Now, it's not really that we want to produce urine because we get rid of it. It's just that we have to, and for the blood's sake, not for the urine's sake. Okay, 17. Well, there's no detail here. This is just a diagram of a human in the anatomical position, by the way. That's the official name of how he is standing, which I'm doing right now. Officially, you have to be naked, so you have to just imagine that, but you probably are anyway. The colored the various regions that we see here will be given names. We'll look at those names in a minute. But on the trunk of the body, or the torso, as opposed to the appendages, there's two major colored regions that we see here. The thorax, or chest area, is one, and then the abdominopelvic area, which is really two areas, the abdomen or abdominal area and the pelvic region. We often combine those into two, though, and say abdominopelvic. So thorax and abdominopelvic region make up the overall torso. We'll give names to these other regions, though, and all of these regions in a little bit. I just want you to realize that we divide the body like this up into different things, each of which have specific names, so that we can very specifically talk about the body and not be ambiguous. Not only the names of regions, but very specific directional terms that need to be properly used so that we know exactly what we're talking about. We don't just say, oh, it's there. You know, there's a specific place on the body that you can use terminology for. Now, speaking of those directional terms, slide 18 starts the presentation of these. Directional terms are mostly comparative rather than absolute, meaning that these words, there's no such thing as a part that is lateral, absolutely. It only makes sense to talk about a part being lateral compared to another part. So these words are used when two parts are compared, their positions. And most of these, not all, but most of these directional terms occur in antonymous pairs. Pairs of antonyms, in other words. What are antonyms? opposites, right? They have opposite meanings. So that's true, for instance, for these first two. Superior and inferior are opposites of each other. So we don't want to say in anatomy and physiology up and down or top and bottom. We use superior and inferior. Now, also, before we get into these terms, I mentioned the anatomical position before, right? This position with palms facing anteriorly. Of course, the body is usually not in this position. But whatever position a body is in, you have to imagine it. You have to imagine putting it into the anatomical position in order to use these comparison words, these directional words. So, for instance, if I stand on my head, that doesn't make my head inferior, because if you imagine me in the anatomical position, my head is still up here. So the head is still superior to the neck, even if I'm standing on my head. You have to imagine putting it in the anatomical position. But superior always means away from gravity, toward the top of the organism. Now, different species each have their own anatomical position. For instance, the anatomical position of a dog, you can probably imagine. It's how it normally stands. It doesn't stand on 2 feet, or it can, but it usually doesn't. So this is our anatomical position. It has a different one. Anyway, superior is always away from the ground. And inferior is just the opposite. It's always toward gravity. Notice that in parentheses, superior has cranial and cephalic listed. These are sometimes used. Superior is always correct. Cranial and cephalic, if you see those, correspond to superior in humans, because cranial means of the cranium, which is the brain case, the bony brain case of the skull, and cephalic means of the head. Well, those are both structures that are pretty, as almost as superior as you can get on the human, right? So that's why they're sometimes used. But get used to using superior. And inferior, sometimes you have caudal, which is a word that means of a tail. Caudus is tail. We don't, as adults, have tails, but we start out with a tail embryologically. And other animals have tails, so that's how that got in use. Usually we just use inferior, though. Okay. Anterior and posterior are also antonyms. Anterior always means toward the front compared to something else, and posterior always means toward the rear. So when we talk about our back, back also means rear, but the back is more than just, I mean, the anterior of the body is more than just what we call the back, right? The rear part of my lower appendage is also in posterior. All right, those are opposites. Let's go to 19. Have another pair, medial and lateral. Now, most animals, including humans, are bilaterally symmetrical, which means they're kind of like a mirror image right to left, defined by a midline, right? That's not true up and down, right? This is not a mirror image of what's down here. It's only right to left mirror imagery. So that's bilateral symmetry, bilateral meaning two sides. And notice, by the way, that that's only superficially true. That's only true for our visible exterior. You know, I don't have two livers and two spleens. So there's asymmetry inside the body to a certain extent, but there's bilateral symmetry outside. And therefore, this longitudinal midline is an important feature of the body, because it defines this, the mirror, basically, across which left and right are reflected. By the way, I just used the word longitudinal. Longitudinal means along the long axis of the body. We're taller than we are wide, so this is the longitudinal direction. Transverse is a word that means at right angles to the long axis. So along the width is longitudinal. And still the third, obviously there's other angles besides those two. Any other angles beside transverse and longitudinal is called oblique. anything that is at a diagonal, for instance, is oblique. But anyway, this midline along the longitudinal axis, right directly between left and right, is a special line because of the symmetry that we have. And medial is a word that refers to how close something is to that midline. So medial means closer compared to something else. A medial structure is closer to that midline. And if you imagine me once again in the anatomical position, for instance, my pinky is medial compared to my thumb. Well, the opposite of that is lateral, which means to the side, right? That's why a football lateral is to the side. My thumb is lateral compared to my pinky. But to demonstrate what I was saying earlier about all of these terms being relative rather than absolute, the pinky is not absolutely medial, right? The pinky is lateral compared to my hip, but at the same time, it's medial compared to my thumb. You use these in comparison. Intermediate is one of the exceptions here. It doesn't really have an opposite. It's used by itself, but it just means between. For instance, my middle finger is intermediate between my thumb and pinky. Proximal and distal are opposites. Proximal has the same root as approximate, right, which means close. So these two words are used two ways, mostly for appendages. Now, the appendages are the limbs, right? You have the trunk or torso, and you have the things that are appended onto it, meaning added onto it. That's why they're called appendages. If you compare two things on an appendage, like the elbow and the wrist, for instance, the proximal one is the one that's closer to the point of attachment of that structure to the torso. So they're both part of the upper limb. The upper limb is attached here at the shoulder. Of those two, the elbow is closer to that point of attachment. So the elbow is proximal to the wrist. The wrist is distal, more distant from that point of attachment. That's one way we use these two. We don't really use them in the trunk so much, except if you're talking about an internal organ that has a direction of flow through it, like the alimentary canal, right? The stomach is a good example of this. The normal flow of material through the stomach is that it enters the stomach in one end, stays in there a while, and then exits into the small intestine. So there is a directionality of flow, and therefore you could talk about that entry as the proximal end of the stomach and the exit as the distal end of the stomach. All right? Superficial and deep are also opposites. Superficial always means closer to the outer surface of the body. And deep is just the opposite. It's closer to the core of the body. So the skin is superficial to just about everything else. Right? There are some hairs that are superficial to the skin, but the skin is our outer surface in most parts of the body. You could say that the skin is superficial to the muscles, for instance. The muscles are deep to the skin. But once again, it's relative, right? The muscles are superficial to most bones. And the bones are deep to the muscles. Well, 21 finally puts labels to this figure we looked at earlier with the regions. Notice that some of these are in bold. So those are the major regions that are then subdivided into subregions. But cephalic is a major region. I said earlier that means of the head. Well, you can divide that into these subregions. Frontal region is the forehead. At the bone of the skull where that is called the frontal bone. Orbital is of the eye sockets. The eye sockets are called orbits, right? Because the eyes themselves are orbs or spheres. That's why they're called the orbits. Nasal, obviously having to do with the nose. That's the nose region. Buccal is a word that means of the cheeks. Oral, mouth, And mental, you might think, has to do with the mind. That's one use of the word. But the word itself, mental, it comes from a root that means mill, which is something that grinds, right? Like a flour mill. So that is the jaw of the body. That's where we grind things. And mental means of the jaw. Okay, next major emboldened one is cervical. Cervical is the adjective form of cervix, C-E-R-V-I-X. A cervix is a narrowing. And so, I have a cervix. All of us has at least one cervix. The cervix that I have is this narrowing right here between the trunk and the head. That's the neck. A neck is a narrowing, right? So this is my cervix. Females have a cervix as their neck, but they also have a neck on their uterus, which is why it's called the cervix. And so this is the cervical region for that reason, and the bones of the vertebral column that are in that region are called called cervical vertebrae. Thoracic is just the adjective of thorax, which is the whole chest region. There's three major subdivisions of it, by the way, I'll talk about that when we get to cavities. As far as the superficial anatomy is concerned, which is what we're looking at here, sternal is this mid region that's named for the sternum, which is the bone in between the ribs here. Axillary is the adjective of axilla, without the R-Y. Axilla is the official name for armpits, or for one armpit. It's plural is axillae, A-X-I-L-L-A-E. So axillary means of that region. Same word, pretty much, that we use for a similar part on a plant, where the major stem branches off. That's an axil on a plant. Pectoral is where you would think it is, because you probably know about most people call them pecs. They're the pectoral muscles that are the real names, but that's this region. And then the abdominal region features superficially the umbilical region. You could probably guess that includes the umbilical cord, the remnants of the umbilical cord. It's been cut by now. The pelvic region is named for the fact that the bones right here, these hip bones, are pelvic bones. So that superficial region is the pelvic region. And then it includes the inguinal region, which also is known as the groin. That's what we usually hear about in sports injuries. They'll say a groin injury. That's the inguinal region. Then there's the pubic region, which is also named for bones here. Each pelvic bone starts out as three bones, ilium, ischium, and pubis, that fuse together. This part is the pubis, the plural of which is pubes. It's P-U-B-E-S. But anyway, that's why that region is called pubic, of the pubes. Okay, now to the upper limb. The limbs are a little bit out of the ordinary with respect to how we usually use words in everyday language outside of anatomy. For instance, most people call this entire limb the arm. But really, anatomically, the arm is only part of that upper limb. The arm is just from shoulder to elbow. And we can call it the arm, but the anatomical word for it is the brachium. And therefore, the adjective is brachial. Brachial means of the arm, but only the true arm anatomically. What comes before the arm, when you're coming from the fingertips toward the point of attachment, is the forearm, but the forearm is called the antebrachium, which means forearm. Ante means before, which is why a poker ante is called that. You put that bet in before you actually start dealing. Or antipasto, you eat before the pasta. That just means before the arm, which is the same thing that forearm means. By the way, I skipped over acromial and deltoid. The acromial region is named for a bone as well. This is the scapula, but on that scapula there is this part right here called the acromion. Notice that it has that acro root in it. What does acro mean? Or what are words that you know that also have acro in them? Acrobat. And probably you know acrophobia. Well, what do acrobats do? They spend time up in the air. And acrophobia is fear of heights. So acro means high. It's the highest part of this bone. That's why it's called that. And therefore that region is acromial. Deltoid region is named for the muscle called the deltoid. Deltoid itself is a word that means like a delta, which is a Greek D, but it looks like an equilateral triangle, and that's the shape of that muscle. That's how it got its name, but that's the region where that muscle is. Antecubital, just like antebrachial means before the arm, antecubital means before the elbow. Cubit means elbow. It's an ancient unit of length, the cubit, which really meant the distance between the elbow of the king and the tip of his fingers, which of course changed every time the king changed, so it's not a very useful system of measurement. But that's what antecubital means, I mean that's what it literally means, but it's talking about the front. That's the sense of before there. So the front aspect, the anterior aspect of the elbow is antecubital. The wrist is also confusing compared to how we usually use the word. Most people would say that this is the wrist. If you just ask them, survey people on the street. This is actually still forearm. The wrist is really part of the hand. The overall hand, by the way, is called the manus, which is why the adjective meaning of the hand is manual, like manual labor, or on an organ there might be several manuals, several keyboards. They're called manuals because you play them with your hand as opposed to the pedals, which you play with the foot or the pedis. So the wrist, which is the carpus, is part of the manus, part of the hand. And it's namely this part right here. That's anatomically the wrist or carpus. And therefore the bones in there are called carpal bones of the carpus. Digital means of the digits. Now you have 20 digits, not just fingers. The toes are also digits, so the digital applies to those as well. Now to the lower limb. Once again, the leg, just like the arm is only part of the upper limb, the leg is only part of the lower limb, but it's not the proximal part like it is for the upper limb. So this is not my leg. What is this? Thigh. Yeah, this is the thigh. This is the leg. The leg, officially, is just from knee to ankle. The thigh, by the way, the thigh region is named femoral, once again, after a bone. The largest bone of the body is the femur, the only bone in each thigh. You just have one in each thigh. That's the femur, so the adjective is femoral. Patellar is the adjective of patella, which is the name for the kneecap. A lot of these are named for bones. Crural is the adjective of crura, without the L. It's crura, which is a word that means leg. That's the official name of the leg. We don't use that very often except in anatomy, but that's what it means. Fibular is also a name for a bone. The leg, unlike the thigh, which has only one bone, the leg has two, tibia and fibula, and they are positioned, like you see on this skeleton, the fibula, which is the more spindly one, is the one that's positioned laterally. So if you're talking about the lateral side of the leg, it's the fibular region. I said earlier that pedis means foot, just like manus means hand, and therefore pedal means of the foot. You would say pedal if you're using an anatomical term, directional term, or region, but we usually say pedal if it's a device that we use with our feet. And tarsal is an adjective of tarsus, which is the official name for the ankle. Just like the carpus, or wrist, was part of the hand, the tarsus, or ankle, is really part of the foot. It's not part of the leg. The leg ends at the tarsus. And there are several bones in the ankle, or tarsus, but that's the region. Calcaneal, oh, that's on the other picture, sorry. I guess we're done with that. Let's look, take a look at the posterior regions. All of that was anterior. A lot of these are repeated because we can see the region from either front or back. So we've talked a lot about these. Olecranon I did not mention because we couldn't see it from the front. The olecranon, which is another word that means elbow, along with cubit, that's this part of this bone. So that region, in other words, it's the posterior view of the elbow rather than antecubital. The posterior view of the elbow is olecranon. We've been through all these. Popliteal is the posterior part of the knee rather than, what was the front called? The anterior view of the knee, what's that region?
Patellar,
exactly, named for the kneecap. Well, the back of the knee is the popliteal region. And sural means of the calf region, so the back of the actual leg, where the calf muscles are. Fibular, well, we already talked about that. Calcaneal is named for a bone as well. One of the tarsal bones is the calcaneus, the biggest one right here that forms the back of the foot that you can stand on. That's the calcaneus. So that region is calcaneal. And plantar refers to the sole. That's why this guy is standing on his toes. Otherwise, you wouldn't see the plantar region. It would be on the floor. Occipital, nape of the neck, basically. The back of the skull has a bony protrusion called the occipital process. That's that region. Scapular is named for a bone, the scapula. Vertebral, obviously named for the vertebral column. The lumbar region, you probably have an adjustment in your car for lumbar support on your seat. That's the bottom of the back. Sacral is also a bony region, a name for a bone. The inferior most of the several vertebrae is this big one right here called the sacrum. So that's the sacral region. And gluteal, the butt region. There are several muscles in here. The biggest one is gluteus maximus, but there's also gluteus minimus and gluteus medius. By the way, it's biggest on us. If you look at a cat, for instance, the gluteus medius is the biggest one. Even though it has a gluteus maximus, which means big, it's not its biggest one. Okay, anyway, those are regions, superficial regions. And so you should use these words, or you should understand these words if someone is telling you, go to this region of the body, you should know where that is, based on those words. Now let's talk about planes of dissection. Dissection means cutting a body, right? Or cutting a part. Well, you can cut any given part of the body, any angle you want. But there are three important directions of cutting that we call the three planes of dissection. There are three categories, really. Each of these categories has infinitely many examples. But what's important about these three with respect to each other is that they are all mutually orthogonal, which is just a fancy way of saying that each of the three is at right angles to the other two. And so they correspond to X, Y, and Z coordinates on a three-dimensional graph, for instance. Okay, if I use a piece of paper, it might be better. Well, you can just look at the slide, too. The blue things are the planes. Now, planes are not real things. They're just imaginary flat planes, right, mathematically. But a sagittal plane is any that is parallel to this folder. This is in a sagittal plane. But so are all of these. Notice there are infinitely many. They're all parallel to each other. Any sagittal plane cuts the body in such a way that it's going to separate a left part from a right part. The reason it's called sagittal, by the way, that sagitt part of the word means arrow. You don't really see it so much on an adult skull, but if you look at a fetal skull, before their soft spots or fontanelles have hardened, this looks like an arrow right here. And the plane that goes right through that stalk of that arrow was therefore called sagittal. Well, I'm sorry, not the plane. The plane was named after the suture. The suture, which is the bony joint, is called the sagittal suture because of that arrow shape. And therefore, the plane that goes through that was called the sagittal plane. Well, there are infinitely many sagittal planes. You don't have to go right through that arrow, like I'm saying. But because of our bilateral symmetry, there is one particular special sagittal plane that goes right through the midline. And that is the only one that is called the median plane. Okay, so the other sagittal planes you wouldn't call the median plane. Median plane is a sagittal, plus there's all kinds of other ordinary sagittal planes. But in all cases, sagittal separates right from left. By the way, speaking of right and left, people confuse this often. It's always that person's body that you're looking at. It's his or her left, not how it looks to you. If you're facing me, my right is going to look on your left, but it's still the right because it's my body you're talking about. Okay? So when you look at a body, imagine putting yourself in that position before you say right or left, and you won't get it confused. A frontal plane, which can also be called a coronal plane, is at right angles to that. Like I said, they're all at right angles to each other. So this is sagittal. Frontal is like this, which is at right angles to this, right? And there are infinitely many of those that you could slice through the body. Now, there's no special one like there was for median because we don't have symmetry front and back. So they're just all called frontal planes or coronal planes. Sutures got... this was another one that's named after sutures. There's a suture that forms between the frontal bone and the two occipital bones. I mean, the two parietal bones. And that looks kind of like a tiara or a crown, which is what coronal means. So coronal was the name of the suture, and the plane that goes through that was therefore called the coronal plane. Any coronal plane of the infinitely many will separate an anterior part from a posterior part, right? And then the only other one that is at that's possible to be at right angles to both of those is a plane like this, which is called a transverse plane. Notice that it's going transversely as opposed to longitudinally. A transverse plane always separates superior from inferior. And there's no special one there for the same reason. There's no symmetry this way. So they're just all transverse planes. Is that all clear? Now you can cut obliquely, of course, as well. There are oblique planes of dissection, but we don't give them special names other than oblique. Usually we cut one of these ways or the other. Okay, 24. Now we're looking inside. This is deeper. And within the trunk, there are a couple major cavities. They can then be subdivided into smaller cavities, but you see them in yellow and red here. The yellow cavity, notice, is the cranial cavity, which is named for the brain case, like I said. This part of the skull, not the face. The skull has the facial bones. But the face is connected in front of the cranium, which is the brain case. It encloses the brain, obviously. So that's called the cranial cavity. That's where the brain is, in the cranial cavity. The rest of the central nervous system is just brain and spinal cord. The spinal cord itself is in the spinal cavity, but it's all one cavity, really, because it's, you know, there's no wall between cranial cavity and spinal cavity. But the abdominopelvic cavity, in red, I mentioned this before. It's really, there is an abdominal cavity and a pelvic cavity, but we often talk about them both at once as abdominopelvic. And that's because it's not a complete division between the two, but they are still considered distinct cavities when you get down to it. And the thoracic cavity is the cavity of the thorax. Now, we're looking at it laterally here, so it only looks like there's one thing, but there's really subdivisions of the thorax, right? I think we talked about this a little bit already when we went around the tables. There's three major parts of the thoracic cavity. There's two big parts, one for each lung. But remember that there's a compartment between the lungs that's still in the thoracic cavity. Do you remember what that's called? It's where the heart is, and it's in a bunch of plumbing as well. Trachea and esophagus. It does start with an M. Do you know any of the other letters? It's called the mediastinum. And notice that media part means between. Whoops. Okay. Oh, I should have said, when I mentioned that there's two overall cavities, those are dorsal and ventral cavities, then they're subdivided into these others. Glad I remember to mention that, though, because the anterior part of us, collectively, is called the anterior surface, is called the venter. And therefore, the adjective of that is ventral. So the ventral and anterior are kind of synonymous for humans, because this is our anatomical position. But the venter always refers to this, the surface that features the chest. Well, think about a dog's anatomical position. Ventral to a dog is not the same thing as anterior. Anterior is toward its front, where it's facing. Its venter is inferior, right? Facing the floor. So it depends on the species. But anyway, that's what ventral means. The back or the posterior aspect is the dorsum. Well, it's posterior for us. For a dog, the dorsal surface would be superior because of how it stands. And that's why a dorsal fin of a shark, for instance, is called a dorsal fin. It's on that dorsum. Now, the abdomen itself is subdivided a couple different ways for convenience. One way is to split it into four areas that are called quadrants, because quad means four. And these have names that you can understand even without thinking about the words. Left upper, right lower, left lower. The only way you can make a mistake here, because I know you all mean you know what right and left and upper and lower mean, is if you don't talk about that person's right or left. Don't talk about your own, how it looks to you. It's that person's left or right, upper and lower. So various organs are in one quadrant or another, but notice that there's nothing saying that an organ has to be only in one quadrant. The stomach is mostly left upper, but it's a little bit right upper as well. And that's, by the way, in normal people. If you have situs inversus, did we talk about this last time? Yeah, so a person with situs inversus would have most of the stomach in the right upper and a little bit in the left upper. So you can divide it into four like we saw, but you can also divide the abdomen into nine regions with a kind of a tic-tac-toe subdivision, as we see on slide 26. And so these regions then are not named just with directional terms. These are named for important parts of the structures in the body. So hypochondriac refers to below the diaphragm. Chondro itself, by the way, means cartilage. So you see that a lot in anatomy words. Whenever you see chondro, it must involve some sort of cartilage. Hypo means below, like in hypodermic, below the skin. Epigastric. Epi means over, meaning superficial to, like the epidermis is superficial part of the skin that's superficial to the dermis, also part of the skin. But gastric means of the stomach, so this is the region that lies over the stomach. Umbilical, where you have the umbilical cord. Lumbar, right and left. We already talked about the lumbar region. Iliac is the adjective of ilium, which is this part, the biggest part of these pelvic bones is the ilium. So that's how those regions got named. And then hypogastric also uses stomach again. Hypo meaning below again. By the way, The stomach is an organ in the abdomen, right? Sometimes we say this whole thing is the stomach in everyday language. It's, if you don't want to use real anatomical terms, you should call this the belly, not the stomach. It's really the abdomen anyway, though. Which I think is the last slide of this show. This has to do with homeostasis, which I don't remember whether I've already defined homeostasis. I don't think I have. Homeostasis is the maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. All living organisms have to maintain homeostasis. In other words, they have to keep conditions in their body, whether it's one cell or multiple cells, within tolerable limits. If things get out of those limits, they die. And familiar example for us is thermostasis, which is just part of homeostasis. It's keeping our body temperature from being too high or too low. You also have to maintain pH. There's all kinds of things you have to maintain, but thermostasis is a familiar way of explaining it. Well, there's all kinds of variables. Temperature is just one example of a variable that needs to be maintained within limits. But whenever you're talking about homeostasis, you're involving a variable. Temperature is an example. Well, if an organism is going to be able to control that variable, in other words, keep it from going outside of the allowable limits, that's not going to happen just automatically. The organism has to do something to keep it within those limits and maintain homeostasis. The way it does that is with feedback mechanisms. Now, there are two categories, broad categories, of feedback mechanisms, which are called negative feedback and positive feedback. Only one of these, importantly, can ever lead to homeostasis, and that is negative feedback. And this is why, by far, almost all feedback mechanisms are negative. There are some examples of positive that I'll get into in a second, but negative feedback mechanisms lead to and maintain homeostasis. So think about that phrase, negative feedback. Negative is the adjective of negate, which means to get rid of, right? Well, whenever you're dealing with a variable that you're trying to control, you have the variable, which is called a variable simply because it can take on multiple values, right? It's not set like a constant, it's a variable. There's also, though, correspondingly a set point, so-called set point, which is the value that you would like that variable to have. In other words, for temperature, the brain has a temperature set point that it would like the body temperature to be at. Well, the body temperature isn't necessarily at the set point at any given moment. It could be higher or lower, right? Because it varies. Well, if it is not right at set point, the variable that is, then there is what we call an error. The error simply is the difference between the set point value, whatever that is, and the true value that the variable is at the moment. In other words, the desired set point, the desired temperature, and the temperature that your body really is at. If they are not the same, then the difference between them will not be zero, right? A zero error means you're right exactly where the set point is, which is what you're trying to achieve. But usually there is some error. And notice that the error can be in either of two directions. Temperature can be too high or too low. It's an error in both cases. Homeostasis means let's get that variable back toward the set point. Whether it's too high or too low, let's get it back to the set point. To do that means let's get rid of the error. Let's negate the error, in other words. And that's why negative feedback is called negative feedback. It negates the error. Brings the variable set closer to the set point, whether it's too high or too low. So I don't want you to think that negative feedback is used if the variable is wrong in one direction and positive feedback is used if the error is in the other direction. That's not true. Negative feedback is used in both cases. And that's why it's the only feedback mechanism that will lead to homeostasis. So, for instance, with you still using temperature as an example, if your body temperature it gets too high, then you start to sweat, right? Which evaporates water from your skin. That sheds heat, brings the body temperature back down, negating the error, making it less. But if you get too cold, you start to shiver. That creates muscular friction, increases the body temperature back up to the set point. So in both cases, negative feedback comes to the rescue and leads to homeostasis. Positive feedback mechanisms do exist, but they never lead to homeostasis because it's the opposite of negative feedback, meaning that positive feedback always makes the error even bigger and drives the variable even farther from the set point than it already was. Most textbooks use the same example, classic example for positive feedback, even though there are others. But a good example to understand is parturition, which is just another name for childbirth. If the fetus is situated normally in the uterus, the head will be down right before birth, inferiorly placed in the uterus, and that will start to stretch the cervix, which is the neck of the uterus, the narrow part. The stretching of that uterus will cause nervous impulses to be sent to the brain, telling the brain, this head is stretching the uterus. The brain responds by releasing a hormone called oxytocin into the bloodstream, like hormones are. That, of course, travels everywhere in the body because the blood is going everywhere, but only the uterus has the right receptors for oxytocin, so it's the only one that really gets the message. And oxytocin tells the uterus to start squeezing from the top, the fundus at the superior part of the uterus, it starts to contract, and that squeezes the fetus inferiorly, which makes the skull of the fetus, or the head, stretch the cervix even more. So it's gotten worse now in terms of error. That sends an even stronger signal to the brain, which responds by releasing even more oxytocin, making it squeeze even harder, and it just keeps building. It's a vicious cycle, a circle. So eventually, if everything goes right, the kid will pop out, in which case that positive feedback mechanism ends. All positive feedback mechanisms have to be temporary, and then they are supplanted by negative feedback mechanisms that will restore homeostasis. All right, that is one chapter.